Imagine, just for a second, that you are the principal investigator running a cutting-edge cognitive science lab.
Right, you're sitting right at the top of the academic food chain.
Exactly. You've got these functional MRI machines just humming in the basement, and I mean, those cost hundreds of dollars an hour just to keep them cooled.
Oh, easily. It's a massive budget.
Yeah, and you have the EEG caps all prepped, a brilliant team of hungry postdocs running around, and you want to make these groundbreaking, paradigm-shifting discoveries about human
You
consciousness.
want to crack the code, basically.
You really do. You want to crack the code of how the mind actually works. But here is the brutal reality of modern academia that nobody really talks about in those glossy university brochures.
The cost of the theory itself.
Right. Developing theoretical frameworks from scratch, building the actual ideas that you want to test in those million-dollar machines, costs upwards of $120,000 a year per researcher.
And it takes years.
Years. You are looking at a minimum of 3 to 5 years of trial and error, philosophical dead ends, and brutal peer review battles before you even have a testable model.
And by the time you have a theory ready to test, well, your grant money has completely dried up.
Exactly. But what if there was a cheat code? What if you could just like lease an external theory division?
Which is such a wild concept for academia.
It really is. Imagine being able to rent leading-edge cognitive models for a fraction of that cost, entirely bypassing the years of theoretical heavy lifting.
It completely flips the traditional academic model on its head. I mean,
Yeah.
usually a lab prides itself on generating its own
Right,
hypotheses,
that's the whole point of a university, isn't it?
generating new ideas, exactly. But in this scenario, you are effectively subscribing to a service that delivers fully formed, mathematically and neurologically grounded frameworks.
And they are just ready for empirical validation.
Precisely. You aren't inventing the blueprint. You're just buying it and building the house.
Yeah.
It's a highly pragmatic, if somewhat controversial, shortcut to the front lines of cognitive neuroscience.
Okay, let's unpack this because today we are taking a deep dive into one of the most fascinating, innovative, and frankly, legally terrifying intellectual properties in the scientific world.
Terrifying is definitely the right word for it.
It's called the Brizard Research Archive. It's a sealed, highly guarded collection of advanced cognitive frameworks created by an independent researcher named Jason Brizard.
And it is heavily locked down.
So locked down. And we are going to look at the exact legal land, the traps and the tripwires that could get a participating lab into serious trouble based on the archive's academic research license agreement.
Setting the stage here, we really have to recognize the basic premise driving this whole enterprise, which is that knowledge is power.
Yeah.
But within the Brizard Archive, knowledge is also a tightly regulated, highly monetized asset. Access to this archive is not some casual gentleman's agreement among scholars.
No, it's not like sharing a Google Doc.
Not at all. It is a locked-down, high-stakes legal contract. The basic value proposition for these academic labs is this: for a $50,000 annual academic license fee, an institution is granted access to publication-ready research infrastructure.
And that accelerates discovery.
Dramatically. It completely removes the bottleneck of theory generation. But, as you mentioned, it comes with conditions that would make a corporate lawyer sweat.
I really want to dig into these legal traps because just reading through this academic research license agreement gave me anxiety.
It's a dense read.
Very. But before we look at the science, we need to understand the playing field. Why are established prestigious labs willing to sign a draconian legal agreement just to get access to theoretical models?
It comes down to pressure.
Right, because I look at the license agreement and it literally says the $50,000 fee, which by the way, you have to pay via wire transfer or institutional check.
No credit cards.
No credit cards, no installment plans. That gets you a 12-month access term to all current and future non-public materials.
The overarching goal of the modern research lab is rapid validation and publication. The funding cycles in modern science are, well, they're viciously short.
You get a grant, and what you have maybe 2 years.
If you're lucky, 2 years to prove you did something worthwhile with it, or you simply don't get the next grant. The pressure to produce is immense.
So it's a time-saving measure.
Exactly. Instead of a lab spending 3 to 5 years sitting in seminar rooms debating the abstract parameters of volition or identity or consciousness, they pay this fee and receive testable, falsifiable models.
And they can just plug those into their fMRI machines.
Right. These models are ready for immediate empirical laboratory application using their existing hardware.
I hear that, but hold on. Aren't labs supposed to invent their own theories? I mean, isn't outsourcing the theory kind of like a rock band buying pre-written songs?
That's a great analogy.
Because if you are just testing someone else's ideas, it feels like it takes the actual science out of the science. It turns a prestigious university lab into, like, a testing facility for an independent contractor.
That is a very common initial reaction, and honestly, it's a fair criticism of how science used to be done. But what's fascinating here is how this mirrors the tech industry's software as a service model.
SaaS, right.
Yeah, SaaS, but applied directly to cognitive neuroscience. Think about it. A tech startup doesn't build its own cloud servers from scratch.
No, they just rent Amazon Web Services.
Exactly, so they can focus on their specific app. Here, the theory isn't the entirety of the science. The labs still have to do the vital, painstaking work of empirical validation.
Which is where the actual proof happens.
Right. True scientific confirmation happens in the testing, the data gathering, the statistical analysis. By shifting the burden of abstract theoretical generation away from the lab, the principal investigator can focus their entire budget and bandwidth on the experimental validation phase.
So it's an economic and strategic division of labor.
Perfectly stated.
Okay, so they pay the 50 grand, the check clears, and they get the keys to the kingdom. A secure digital transfer delivers these frameworks, but this kingdom is heavily guarded.
Understatement of the year.
If you read this agreement, it is an absolute minefield. I want to spend some real time transitioning into the legal restrictions placed on these researchers because it is wild. This isn't just about protecting a copyright. This is about controlling the flow of information on a molecular level.
It is an incredibly restrictive document. Section 2.1 lays down a strict 5-year confidentiality period for any unreleased materials.
5 years.
Yep. And this applies from the date of delivery. And the kicker is, it survives even if the agreement expires or is terminated.
So you can't just cancel your subscription and start talking about it?
Absolutely not. The only way the confidentiality lifts is if Jason Brizard himself formally publishes it, releases it through an authorized channel, or waives it in writing.
Let's talk about how easy it is to breach this, because the consequences are nuclear. We've gone through the document and mapped out some very realistic scenarios where a lab could face immediate termination.
And termination means losing everything.
Right. Just to be clear, Section 7.2 says no refunds under any circumstances. You mess up on day 2 of your 12-month lease, you lose the $50,000.
And you lose access to all the models your lab is currently testing.
Which freezes your entire pipeline. So, scenario A, let's call it the colloquium catastrophe.
A very apt name.
Mm-hmm.
So under Section 2.4, the agreement does allow for internal academic dialogue about the archive.
Okay, so you can talk to your team.
Yes. You can discuss it in controlled, non-public settings like lab meetings or departmental colloquia, but the conditions are absolute.
It's like an academic fight club. The first rule of the Brizard Archive is you don't record the Brizard Archive.
Exactly. No materials can be distributed. Everyone in the room must be bound by a non-disclosure agreement or a strict institutional confidentiality policy.
And crucially, absolutely no audio or video recordings are made.
None. Let's put this into a real-world context. Imagine a prominent lab has licensed the archive. They are holding a closed-door departmental colloquium to discuss a new way to map visual processing using one of Brizard's unreleased frameworks.
Sounds like a standard Tuesday for a research lab.
Right. But say a visiting scholar from another university is sitting in the back of the lecture hall. They were invited by a colleague. Maybe they signed a basic sign-in sheet with a confidentiality clause at the bottom that they barely read.
Nobody reads those.
Exactly. So during the presentation, the principal investigator puts up a slide showing a highly complex proprietary mathematical loop from the archive.
And the visiting scholar thinks, oh, wow, this concept is brilliant.
So what do they do? What does everyone do in 2026? They discreetly pull out their smartphone and snap a picture, or they hit record on their voice memo app to capture the speaker's explanation so they can review it later.
Boom, the lab is in breach, and they don't even know it yet.
Because the agreement explicitly states that notes containing direct quotes, screenshots, or structural reproductions cannot be shared externally, and sessions must not be audio or video recorded. Period.
It doesn't matter if the PI didn't know the visiting scholar was recording.
It doesn't matter if the recording was never even published. The act of the recording occurring in that room, if discovered, triggers Section 7.3.
Immediate termination by the licensor.
Just like that.
And there goes your $50,000, your research pipeline is frozen, and your grad students who are basing their dissertations on this framework are suddenly out of luck.
But wait, how would Broussard even find out? Is he auditing these labs?
The scientific community is small and rumors travel fast.
That's true.
If that visiting scholar goes back to their home institution and casually mentions, hey, I saw this amazing equation at the colloquium last week, and shows the smartphone picture to a colleague who happens to be a Broussard licensee.
Oh, wow. It gets back to the source. Or, more commonly, that visiting scholar might innocently incorporate that concept into a preprint paper 6 months later, not realizing it's highly confidential proprietary architecture.
Because they just thought it was a cool idea they heard at a lecture.
Exactly. And Broussard monitors preprint servers meticulously. Once the structural reproduction is out there, the audit trail leads right back to the colloquium.
That is terrifying. You have to police your own colleagues like a warden.
Okay, let's look at scenario B, which I think is even more insidious. The custom framework crap.
Ah, yes. Section 5.4.
Right. Under Section 5.4, a lab can voluntarily submit their own raw experimental data to Broussard to request that he build a custom framework specifically for them.
Let's say a lab has spent a year gathering incredibly dense, high-resolution behavioral data on decision-making fatigue.
Costing tons of grant money.
Yes. They have the data, but they can't figure out the underlying cognitive architecture. They can package that raw data and send it to the Broussard archive, effectively saying, can you build us a bespoke theoretical model that explains this specific data set? Now, if I am the principal investigator and I just spent a year of my life and hundreds of thousands of dollars to gather that fMRI data, I am assuming that if I supply the underlying materials, I would retain some level of joint ownership over the resulting theoretical framework.
It seems logical.
I brought the bricks, you built the house, we own the house together.
Well, the legal reality, as dictated by Section 5.4, completely destroys that assumption.
Completely.
Broussard retains sole ownership of the resulting framework, including its structure, language, and symbols. The origin of the data does not affect ownership whatsoever.
So what does the lab get?
The lab merely receives leaseback rights, a non-exclusive license to use the framework internally during their term.
Wait, hold on. Let me get this straight. I hand over my lab's hard-won data. I ask someone to build a theory out of it. They build it. And then I have to rent that theory back from them.
That is correct.
And submitting the data grants me absolutely zero authorship rights over the theory. That sounds like academic theft. How is that legally permissible?
In any normal industry, your instinct would be correct. But here, the contract explicitly defines the raw empirical data as inert material.
Inert material. Wow.
The intellectual property is not the data itself. The intellectual property is the interpretive architecture applied to the data.
So he's basically saying my data is just a pile of rocks until he builds something with it.
Basically. The contract states that the lab owns their raw data forever. They just don't own the Broussard-authored framework built on top of it. And it gets worse for the lab's ego.
How could it be worse?
The lab is legally required to include a citation in their future publications saying the framework was created by Jason Broussard using data provided by their institution.
So I pay for the privilege of giving him my data. He builds a model. He owns the model. I rent it from him, and I have to publicly thank him for using my data.
It is a masterclass in intellectual property control.
It really is.
It's a brilliant, if ruthless, way to crowdsource raw empirical data from the world's top labs while maintaining an absolute iron grip on the resulting intellectual property. Broussard can then take that custom framework, incorporate it into his broader master models, and release it publicly or license it to other labs without giving the original lab any further claim or royalty.
Okay, scenario C, the formatting faux pas. This one blew my mind because it feels so petty, but legally it is a bear trap.
Section 3.
Yeah, Section 3 dictates the use of something called the Broussard format. What exactly is this?
This is a proprietary structural template authored by Broussard specifically for organizing and formatting theoretical manuscripts.
So it's not just like double space Times New Roman.
No, it is not just a font choice or a margin size. It has a specific section sequence, a unique formatting logic for how variables are presented, and a highly specific placeholder schema for integrating empirical data with theoretical claims.
It's a document template. It's essentially a really complicated Microsoft Word or LaTeX template.
But the license agreement treats it like it is highly sensitive, weapons-grade software.
And if the lab's license expires, say they don't have the 50 grand to renew next year, they must immediately cease using the Broussard format for any new projects.
Immediately. And the restrictions on this format are sweeping. They cannot adapt it. They cannot turn it into a toolkit for their grad students. They cannot post it on their lab website as a standalone writing guide.
Imagine the friction this introduces into a lab's workflow. You have a team of postdocs who have spent 12 months learning how to write their papers in this highly specific, very efficient Resart format. It becomes second nature to them.
It's muscle memory.
Right. Then the lab's license expires. 6 months later, one of those postdocs is writing a completely unrelated paper on, I don't know, auditory processing in mice. They aren't using Resart's theories at all.
But out of sheer habit, they use the structural sequence and formatting logic of the Resart format to organize their manuscript.
Is that a breach?
That is a direct legal violation of Section 3. The format itself is protected IP. It speaks to a deep systemic desire by the archive to control not just the ideas themselves, but the very architecture of how those ideas are communicated and structured in the real world.
Which brings us to scenario D, the citation slip-up. We all know academic citations can be tedious. You use APA or MLA or Chicago style. But Section 4 of this agreement doesn't just ask for a standard citation.
No, it mandates an exact, inflexible word-for-word phrasing.
And what is that phrase?
The mandated phrase is, "This research utilized theoretical materials licensed from the Brizart Research Archive, authored by Jason Brizart."
And a lab must use that exact phrasing in the main text, footnotes, or acknowledgments. You miss a comma, or a graduate student decides to paraphrase the acknowledgment because it flows better in the concluding paragraph of their paper, and the whole lab is in jeopardy.
Failure to include this specific attribution is explicitly listed as grounds for termination under Section 7.3.
Are you telling me that if a brilliant postdoc writes a paper that cures a specific type of cognitive aphasia, but they write, "We thank Jason Brizart and his archive for the theoretical materials used in this study," instead of the exact mandated sentence, the lab's access gets terminated?
Legally, yes. The licensor has the absolute right to terminate. Whether they would enforce it over a slight paraphrase might depend on the situation, but the legal vulnerability is unquestionable.
It's hanging over their heads.
Exactly. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, you have to wonder about the massive chilling effect this might have on the day-to-day culture of a research lab.
Oh, for sure.
We are dealing with graduate students and postdocs who have grown up in an era defined by open source software, preprint servers like BioArchs4, and collaborative cloud folders. Their entire academic instinct is to share, to upload, to circulate, to crowdsource problem solving.
Right. If you get stuck on a coding problem for your data analysis, you post the snippet on a public GitHub repository or a Reddit forum to get help.
But one accidental upload of a Brizart equation to a public forum violates Section 2.2.
And that triggers the termination clause.
It forces a university research lab to operate with the operational security of a military intelligence agency. The friction that introduces into the scientific process is immense. You have principal investigators who are probably spending as much time policing their students' Dropbox accounts as they are reviewing the actual science.
So we have painted a picture of a legal nightmare. You have to pay $50,000. You can't record your own meetings. You don't own the theories built from your own data. You have to use a proprietary font and template. And one wrong tweet from a grad student ruins the whole operation.
It sounds bleak when you put it like that.
With all these legal traps, with the constant threat of losing 50 grand and having your research halted, why on earth would any principal investigator sign this?
Because the reward is staggering.
The actual science.
Yes. The frameworks inside the archive are not just competent or mildly interesting. They're described as incredibly potent. They're highly integrated, mechanistically precise models that solve deep, intractable problems in cognitive neuroscience.
So they actually work.
They work beautifully. These aren't just vague psychological concepts. They're testable, mathematical architectures of human thought.
And this brings us to the real meat of this deep dive. We've talked about the lockdown secretive side of the archive, but the reason we are talking about this at all is because Jason Brizart has recently lifted the confidentiality on four foundational pillars of his work.
As of March 2026.
Right. He has formally released four interlocking frameworks to the public on Zenodo. Those are PFT, TFL, SST, and IRE.
Zenodo is a public, open-access repository for research data and publications. By formally publishing these four frameworks there, Brizart triggers Section 2.5 of his own licensing agreement.
Okay, what does that section do?
That section states that formally published frameworks are no longer subject to the confidentiality period. By releasing them, he gives the global scientific community a massive, unrestricted glimpse into the architecture he has been building in secret.
And I was digging into the timeline of this release, and there is a detail that I find absolutely fascinating. If you look at the Brizard Archive blog, Brizard actually took a massive 260-day break from posting any updates.
Yes, from July 2025 to March 2026.
Almost a full 9 months of total radio silence. He didn't just write these theories in a week and publish them. He explicitly states in his notes that he spent that 260-day period in, quote, intensive cross-framework mapping and lived validation.
Lived validation is a profound term in this context.
That's exactly what caught my eye. What does that actually mean? Because he implies that he lived these frameworks.
He did.
He was noticing his own cognitive loops in real time, meaning these aren't just cold equations drawn on a whiteboard in a vacuum. They're intimately mapped human experiences. He was testing the math against his own subjective reality.
That is a crucial point to understand before we dive into the theories themselves. He talks about needing periods of rest during those 260 days because the human organism required pauses to sustain the depth of focus demanded.
Wow.
He was constantly observing his own unresolved simulations, analyzing his own emotional rebounds when dealing with people, and tracking his own intention vectors when deciding what to do next. It lends an intense phenomenological weight to the models.
Phenomenology being the philosophical study of the structures of experience.
Exactly. These aren't just descriptions of abstract brains in a jar. They are a highly formalized description of his brain, mapped into a universal architecture.
It's almost like he built a mirror out of mathematics, looked into it for 9 months, and then published the blueprints for the mirror.
That's a beautiful way to put it.
And the overall architecture of these four frameworks is stunning. These aren't four random disconnected theories about the brain. They fit together seamlessly to form a complete self-regulating cognitive loop.
If we synthesize the architecture before we break it apart, PFT, or perceptual framing theory, provides the moment-to-moment content of consciousness. It is the snapshot.
Okay, the snapshot.
Then TFL, the temporal feedback loop, takes those snapshots and strings them together across time to create the movie of your life.
Snapshots into a movie. Got it.
Then SST, simulation synchronization theory, projects that internal movie into the social environment to stabilize your sense of identity among other people.
So taking the movie and showing it to an audience.
Yes. And finally, IRE, the intent resolution engine, takes the feedback from the social environment and decides what physical action you are going to take.
Which in turn generates the very next sensory snapshot in PFT.
Precisely. It is a closed loop of human existence. Snapshots into a movie projected to society, leading to an action which creates the next snapshot.
I love that. So let's break down this loop, starting at the absolute base layer of experience. How do we build a conscious moment? That is pillar one, perceptual framing theory, or PFT.
PFT was the final piece to be released just recently on March 21st, 2026. It addresses one of the most massive foundational questions in cognitive science. How does the human brain transform a chaotic flood of raw sensory input, like photons hitting the retina, sound waves vibrating the eardrum, into a coherent, emotionally meaningful experience?
Right, because traditional models often view perception as a relatively passive receiving of data. You open your eyes and the world just pours in.
But PFT completely rejects that passive model. It posits that conscious experience is an active, recursive construction shaped by interpretive frames.
Let me make sure I'm getting this. It says perception is not simply received like a radio antenna picking up a signal. It is actively framed.
Precisely. To explain how this framing works, PFT formalizes it using a specific tuple, a mathematical sequence of four components.
The famous F equals P, M, A, I.
Exactly. But let's avoid the raw math and look at what those components actually represent. The four elements of a perceptual frame are perceptual anchors, contextual memory, affective tone, and interpretive structure.
Let's translate that into a real-world scenario. Let's say it's late at night, and you get a vague text message from your boss that just says, "We need to talk first thing tomorrow."
The classic anxiety-inducing text.
The worst. Walk me through how PFT builds the conscious experience of reading that text.
Perfect example. Let's build the frame. The first component is the perceptual anchors, the P. This is the raw sensory data processed by the posterior sensory networks in your brain. In this case, it is simply your visual cortex recognizing the glowing white pixels on your dark smartphone screen forming the shapes of letters.
That is the raw input. But those pixels mean nothing on their own. Like a baby looking at that screen just sees light.
Exactly. So the brain immediately pulls in the second component, contextual memory, the M. This relies on your hippocampal and parahippocampal circuits. Your brain rapidly searches for prior instances of this input.
Have you received a text like this before?
Right. What happened last time your boss said we need to talk? Did someone get fired? Did you get a promotion?
Let's assume the worst. Let's say the last time you got a vague text, you were severely reprimanded.
In that case, the contextual memory informs the third component, the affective tone, which is the A. This is driven by the amygdala and the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. Because the memory is negative, the amygdala fires, flooding the frame with a negative emotional charge.
Fear, anxiety, a spike in heart rate.
Yes. So now we have the pixels, the memory of a past reprimand, and a feeling of fear.
How does it all come together?
That is the final component, the interpretive structure, the I, supported by the medial prefrontal cortex. This is the narrative your brain tells itself to bind the first three things together.
The story you tell yourself.
Right. The interpretive structure becomes, I am in trouble. I am going to lose my job. These four systems, the visual cortex, the hippocampus, the amygdala, and the prefrontal cortex, lock together in a matter of milliseconds to create a single frame of reality. You don't consciously experience the pixels, then the memory, then the fear, then the thought. You experience them simultaneously as a single unified reality. My boss is angry at me.
I love to compare PFT to a smartphone camera applying a filter in real time. Think about when you open a social media app and put a vintage high contrast filter on your camera. As you move the phone around the room, you aren't seeing the raw sensor data of the light hitting the lens.
No, you're seeing the processed image.
You are seeing the room after the shadows are deepened, the colors are shifted, and the artificial grain is applied. PFT says your brain is doing that constantly. You never, ever see raw, objective reality. You only ever experience reality after the memory, the emotion, and the narrative filter have been applied.
That is an exceptionally accurate analogy, and PFT outlines a five-phase cycle for how these mental filters, these frames, are built and dismantled, operating on timescales as short as 100 milliseconds.
Okay, let's follow your text message example through the five phases.
First is priming, where your brain activates several candidate frames the moment the text arrives. Maybe one frame is, I'm getting fired. Another is, I'm getting promoted. And another is, he just needs an update on a project.
Then comes the second phase, arbitration. The brain has to pick one. How does it choose?
It selects the best fitting frame based heavily on emotional congruence. If you have been feeling insecure about your job lately, meaning your baseline affective tone is already negative, the brain's arbitration phase is going to select the I'm getting fired frame simply because it matches your pre-existing mood.
So the brain loves emotional consistency, even if it's negative.
Exactly.
So if I'm already stressed, my brain actively chooses to interpret ambiguous information as a threat. That is brutal, but so human.
It is. And that leads to the third phase, stabilization. Once the threat frame is chosen, it is reinforced by the brain's default mode network and salience networks. It binds all that sensory data into a unified, rock-solid experience. You feel absolutely certain that you are in trouble. Your reality is locked in.
But then, eventually, comes phase four, disruption.
This is when reality refuses to cooperate with your filter.
Let's say you go into work the next morning terrified, and your boss says, hey, I just wanted to talk about organizing a surprise birthday party for Sarah in accounting.
The relief. Exactly. The incoming sensory data, the boss smiling, talking about a birthday party, sharply contradicts the stabilized frame of, I am getting fired. The frame cannot hold the contradiction, so it destabilizes and collapses.
That makes sense.
This leads to the final phase, closure, where the newly resolved frame, everything is fine, we are planning a party, undergoes reconsolidation in the hippocampus, updating your memory for the next time you get a vague text.
But what happens when the disruption phase fails? Why is PFT considered such a breakthrough clinically?
PFT provides a mechanistically precise explanation for clinical conditions like severe anxiety or PTSD. In a traumatized brain, a frame becomes hyperstable. It exhibits severe cognitive rigidity.
It gets stuck.
Yes. The amygdala is so hyperactive that the arbitration phase almost always chooses a threat-based frame, regardless of the actual context. The person is locked in a continuous loop, applying a danger filter to completely neutral situations. They interpret a stranger walking too fast on the sidewalk or a loud noise as a life-threatening event because their frame is fixed and refuses to enter the disruption phase.
So in therapy, when someone has a massive breakthrough, that sudden, tearful aha moment where they realize they aren't in danger anymore, what is physically happening in the brain according to PFT?
According to this framework, that breakthrough is essentially a maladaptive frame finally collapsing under the weight of new evidence and therapeutic guidance, allowing a healthier frame to stabilize. But Brizard doesn't just leave it as a metaphor. PFT predicts this frame collapse will be marked by measurable physical brain activity, specifically a phenomenon called theta-gamma coupling.
Okay, can you explain theta-gamma coupling like I'm five? What does that actually mean?
Think of brain waves like an orchestra. Theta waves are very slow, deep, foundational brain waves, like the heavy beat of a bass drum. They often relate to memory and spatial navigation in the hippocampus.
Okay, bass drum.
Gamma waves are incredibly fast, high-frequency waves, like a flurry of violins. They're associated with intense focus and the binding of different sensory inputs into a single conscious thought.
Violins, got it.
In PFT, when a stubborn traumatic frame finally breaks down and reorganizes into a healthier perspective, the slow theta waves from the memory centers perfectly sync up or couple with the fast gamma bursts in the prefrontal cortex.
The bass drum and the violins hit the exact same rhythm for a split second.
Exactly. It is the literal electrical signature of your mind changing its structure.
That is unbelievable. It moves therapy from this vague conversational concept of changing your mind to a mechanistically precise dismantling of neural scaffolding.
Okay, so PFT gives us the individual frames of reality, these 100-millisecond snapshots. But life isn't a single photograph or even a slideshow. Life feels fluid.
It feels like a movie.
Right, but wait, if my brain is just taking a bunch of 100-millisecond snapshots, why doesn't my life feel like a stop-motion film? How is the brain stitching these flashes together to create the illusion of continuous time?
That exact question brings us to pillar two, the temporal feedback loop, or TFL.
Which was released a bit earlier in June 2025.
Correct. TFL tackles the continuity of conscious experience. It models how consciousness loops those brief perceptual frames we just discussed. TFL introduces an integration function. Instead of getting bogged down in the algebra, let's look at the four ingredients the brain is constantly mixing together in this loop to create your sense of the present moment.
Let's do it. What are the four ingredients?
The first is input, what is physically happening to your senses right now. The second is memory, what has happened in the past. The third is simulation, your brain's prediction of what is going to happen next. And the fourth is emotion, your current affective state.
Input, memory, simulation, and emotion.
TFL says your brain is constantly recursively integrating these four things into a loop, hundreds of times a second.
But in reading the framework, it seems like emotion is the real heavyweight champion here.
It absolutely is. The crucial element in the TFL loop is the emotional weighting, or affective salience. Emotion acts as a loop amplifier. If a simulation of the future lacks emotional intensity, it decays and disappears quickly.
Give me an example of a low emotion loop decaying.
You are sitting at your desk and you think, I should probably buy milk on the way home. You run a quick mental simulation of walking into the grocery store. But it's not a highly charged thought. You don't feel passionate about the milk.
Yeah, it's just milk.
Right. So the simulation fades. Maybe you remember to buy it. Maybe you don't. The loop opens and it closes easily. But what happens if a simulation is highly emotional?
Right. Say you have a massive presentation tomorrow and you run a simulation of yourself tripping on the stage and dropping your notes.
Exactly. Because that simulation is attached to intense fear and social anxiety, it doesn't decay. Emotion acts like a glue that forces the simulation to persist. It re-enters the temporal feedback loop recursively. It plays over and over in your head, keeping you awake at night.
This perfectly explains a phenomenon that Brizard calls delayed role enactment, which I found incredibly relatable. Walk me through how a persistent loop causes delayed actions.
Let's set up a scenario. You are in a meeting and a colleague condescendingly talks over you. In that 100-millisecond window, your brain runs a simulation. You standing up, slamming your hand on the table and telling them to stop interrupting.
But I don't do it. The social context is wrong. My boss is in the room. I freeze. I let the moment pass. I assume the thought just went away.
But according to TFL, it didn't go away. Because that simulation of defending yourself was highly charged with anger and indignation, it didn't decay. It remained active in the background of your cognitive architecture, constantly cycling through the temporal feedback loop, searching for an opportunity to resolve itself.
So what happens 3 days later?
3 days later, you are at a coffee shop, and the barista gets your order wrong and is slightly dismissive about it.
Yeah.
Suddenly you snap. You raise your voice, you assert yourself forcefully, and you demand a new coffee. It feels completely out of proportion to the mistake.
Because I'm not actually yelling about the coffee.
Exactly. TFL says that highly emotional simulation of defending your boundaries from the meeting didn't disappear. It just kept cycling until the context was safe enough.
Yelling at a barista had lower social stakes than yelling at a colleague in front of a boss.
Precisely. And then the loop finally executed the action to close itself. The simulation encoding preceded the behavioral expression by 3 whole days.
That explains so much about human behavior that seems irrational or out of the blue. You see someone blow up over a minor inconvenience and you think they're crazy. But TFL says they aren't crazy, they're just closing a highly amplified loop from a past event.
Exactly.
But what if you can't ever take the action? What if the person who insulted you was a CEO you can never yell at? Does the loop just spin forever, causing chronic stress?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, TFL proposes a fascinating, almost poetic mechanism for how these loops can finally close without physical action. Brizard calls it observational resolution.
I love this part. The idea that you can close the loop just by watching someone else, how does that work?
Sometimes, a persistent, unresolved emotional simulation can resolve through passive observation. Let's go back to the anger at the colleague. You are harboring this unresolved loop of conflict. A week later, you are watching a dramatic movie where the protagonist is being bullied by a corrupt boss.
Okay.
The protagonist finally stands up, delivers a scathing monologue, and quits.
And I feel this immense wave of satisfaction watching it.
Yes, because as you watch that scene, your brain effectively registers a match between your internal unresolved simulation and the external events on the screen. The observation provides the necessary emotional feedback to discharge the weighting of your own loop.
The loop closes.
The tension dissipates, and you never had to actually confront your colleague.
That is incredible. It explains the entire evolutionary purpose of storytelling. It explains why we are so drawn to movies or tragedy or drama or even reality TV. We aren't just entertaining ourselves. We are actively using fictional characters to close our own open TFL loops through observational resolution. It is psychological hygiene.
It truly is. It's the cognitive mechanics of catharsis. But of course, we don't just sit in dark rooms observing fiction. We are forced to interact with real people, real feedback, and real social environments.
Which perfectly sets up the next roadblock. If TFL explains how we string our internal frames across time and occasionally resolve them by watching movies, well, what happens when we step outside? We don't live in a vacuum. I am not the only person generating loops.
Far from it.
I have to deal with the loops of my family, my friends, my coworkers. How does my internal timeline survive the collision with society?
That collision is exactly what Pillar 3 addresses. Simulation Synchronization Theory, or SST. Also released in June 2025. SST tackles the deeply complex concept of human identity. It proposes that the self is not a static trait. You don't have a fixed personality locked away inside a vault in your brain.
It's an active process.
Identity is a living, emergent process of constantly testing your internal simulations against external reality. It relies on a specific 4-step feedback loop.
Let's walk through the steps of this identity loop.
The loop is simulation to role to feedback to adaptive response. You generate a simulation, an internal expectation of who you are in a given social moment. For example, I am a competent, respected professional.
Okay, that's the simulation.
You project that simulation into the world by enacting a role. You dress a certain way, you speak with a certain vocabulary, you carry yourself with authority.
And then the world pushes back, the feedback phase.
Exactly. The environment, specifically other people, provides feedback. They either listen to you respectfully, which confirms the simulation, or they interrupt you and roll their eyes, which contradicts it.
Ouch.
And then comes the final step, the adaptive response. You have to adapt to the feedback. You either reinforce the simulation because the feedback confirmed it, or you modify your behavior. Yeah. Or if the feedback is harsh enough, the simulation collapses entirely.
You literally simulate who you are, test it on the public, and measure the results. If someone approves, the simulation stabilizes and becomes a solid piece of your identity. If they reject it, you feel insecure.
That's the core of it.
Brizard wrote this amazing blog post to explain this called Emotional Rebound When You Don't Let It In. He talks about the exact microsecond when someone projects negativity at you, like someone insults your intelligence or dismisses your hard work. What is computationally happening in the brain in that millisecond?
Beneath the surface of your conscious awareness, your cognitive system is asking a rapid computational question. Do I let this feedback in? Do I integrate this into my identity? SST says that your emotional boundary, your ability to defend your self-esteem, is not just some vague psychological wall you build in therapy. It is a computational evaluation process.
Let's slow down and look at that evaluation. If someone snaps at me and calls me an idiot, My brain instantly creates a simulation of what it would mean to accept that feedback, to accept the role of someone who is an idiot and deserves to be snapped at.
Correct. But here is where SAT gets deeply empowering. It says that a healthy mind uses its volitional systems to evaluate that negative simulation against its core, stabilized memories of competence.
So it checks the receipts.
Exactly. It looks at the insult,
yeah,
calculates the source, checks its own history, and effectively says, no, the data does not support this feedback. This isn't me. I reject the synchronization, the emotional boundaries enforced mathematically.
I love that. But it's never a perfect shield, right? Even if someone insults you and you know they are wrong, it still hurts a little bit.
And Brizard accounts for that. He points out that even if a little bit of the sting gets through what he formally calls partial synchronization, it isn't necessarily a failure of your boundaries.
Oh, that's reassuring.
Your system is designed to take a tiny fragment of that negative affect, evaluate the pain, reject the core premise of the insult, and integrate the experience of having defended yourself. The cut heals into a scar, and that scar actually strengthens your overall coherence. You learn that you can survive an insult without your identity collapsing.
So what does this all mean for our overall sense of self? If we are constantly relying on feedback to stabilize our simulations, are we just chameleons? Are we entirely dependent on whoever we happen to be talking to?
Not if the internal effect of waiting, the emotional strength of your baseline simulation, is strong enough. If you have a highly stable, deeply held simulation of your own value generated from years of positive experiences, you can withstand massive amounts of disconfirming feedback.
The haters' feedback just bounces off.
Right. The mismatch between who you know you are and how poorly someone is treating you creates psychological dissonance, yes. But your internal loop resists suppression. You don't believe the insult.
But what if you are trapped in a toxic environment? What if a child grows up in an abusive home where the feedback is chronically negative?
That is where SST explains the tragedy of environmental trauma. If the external feedback is chronically contradictory to a healthy simulation, or if positive feedback is entirely absent, the internal loop eventually fragments. The brain cannot sustain a simulation that the environment constantly punishes.
That's heartbreaking.
It is. This explains identity instability, dissociation, and the intense psychological friction of being in an environment that constantly invalidates your projected role. Your identity literally cannot synchronize.
It proves scientifically that we need a supportive world that reflects our best selves back to us, but we also have the internal machinery to reject a distorted reflection when necessary. And that machinery, the system that actually makes the final call on what to accept, what to reject, and what physical action to take to change our environment, that is the final piece of the puzzle. We have the frames, we have the timeline, we have the social feedback. But how do we actually do anything about it?
That brings us to Pillar 4, the Intent Resolution Engine, or IRE.
Also released in June 2025, this is the one that really hit home for me.
IRE models volitional arbitration. In plain English, it answers the ultimate human question. Why do we sometimes fail to take action on what we consciously desperately want to do? Why do we procrastinate, hesitate, or feel utterly paralyzed when we know exactly what steps we need to take?
Everyone listening to this right now has experienced this. You know exactly what you need to do. You need to write that difficult email. You need to go to the gym. You need to sit down and do your taxes. You want to do it. But you sit on the couch and you don't.
And society tells us that this is a moral failing.
Right. Society says you are lazy, or you lack willpower, or you lack discipline. But IRE completely removes the moral judgment from procrastination. It says you don't have a weak soul. You have a system-level bottleneck in your dorsolateral prefrontal cortex.
Exactly. IRE reduces the concept of an intention to a mathematical vector. An intention is not just a wish floating in the ether. It is a neurological force composed of five specific calculable variables.
Let's break down these five variables because they map perfectly onto real life.
The variables are CA, XR, and UC is cognitive relevance. How intellectually important does your brain think this goal is?
Okay, C is relevance.
A is effective charge. How much raw emotion or passion is behind it? X is contextual fit. Does your physical and social environment support this action right now?
X is the context. Got it.
R is reward expectancy. What is the neurochemical payoff if you succeed? And U is urgency. What is the consequence if you delay?
So let's say my intention is going to the gym after a long day at work. My brain rapidly calculates the vector. Cognitive relevance, C is high. I know exercise is good for me.
But effective charge A is low. You hate the treadmill and you're tired.
Exactly. Contextual fit X is terrible. I am already on my couch in my work clothes.
Reward expectancy R is delayed. You won't see abs for 6 months.
And urgency, you is zero. Nothing bad happens today if I skip it. So my overall intention vector for the gym is incredibly weak.
Precisely. Your brain constantly calculates these five variables for every possible action you could take in any given second, creating dozens of competing intention vectors. But here is the brilliant insight of IRE. These vectors do not compete directly against each other.
The gym vector isn't wrestling the watch TV vector.
No. Instead, all vectors compete against a dynamic limit called the resolution threshold.
I picture the resolution threshold like a bouncer at a very exclusive nightclub. Your intentions, the vectors, are the people trying to get into the club. If they get in, they become physical actions. Now, if you wake up on a Saturday, well-rested, highly motivated, after a great cup of coffee, the bouncer lowers the velvet rope.
The threshold is low.
Right. Even a weak intention, like, I should probably organize my sock drawer, can easily get past the bouncer, enter the club, and become an action.
But the threshold is dynamic. It changes constantly based on your physiological state. If you are stressed, fatigued, experiencing cognitive overload from a long day at work, or navigating a high-conflict environment, the subthalamic nucleus and orbitofrontal cortex in your brain actively raise that threshold.
The bouncer becomes incredibly strict.
Very strict.
Right. You come home exhausted, the threshold spikes, the bouncer turns into a tyrant, and suddenly even your best, most important intentions, the VIPs with high cognitive relevance and high reward expectancy, like work on my novel or cook a healthy dinner, they get turned away at the door. They aren't strong enough to cross the fatigue threshold.
So what gets into the club?
The only things that get in are actions that require zero effort. You sit on the couch and scroll on your phone for 3 hours because scrolling requires an intention vector strength of near zero. It slips right under the velvet rope.
This raises an important question. And it is the true beauty of the IRE framework as a tool for living. It gives us a clear mechanism for intervention. When you are stuck, paralyzed, or procrastinating, the self-help industry tells you that you need to increase your motivation. You need to artificially pump up your effective charge.
Listen to a hype playlist, watch a motivational video.
But IRE says that is often the hardest way to change behavior.
If the bouncer is demanding a $1,000 cover charge, you don't try to go find $1,000. You figure out how to lower the cover charge.
Exactly. You don't always need stronger vectors. You might just need to lower your resolution threshold. You do that by reducing cognitive load, stepping away from environmental stress, taking a nap, or eating something to restore glucose levels.
Lower the threshold, and your existing intentions will naturally initiate action.
Alternatively, you can artificially manipulate the variables of the vector itself. If the gym vector is too weak, you increase the urgency, the you, by making a bet with a friend that you have to pay them $50 if you don't show up.
Or you increase contextual fit, X, by putting your gym clothes on before you even leave the office so the environment supports the action.
It makes human behavior so tractable. You aren't fighting a war for your soul. You are balancing an equation. You are managing your vectors and your thresholds. And when you step back and look at PFT, TFL, SST, and IRE as an integrated suite, when you see how beautifully they explain the mechanics of being alive, you finally understand why a university lab would risk a $50,000 license fee, sign away their data rights, and operate under draconian legal restrictions just to get access to Brizart's unreleased work.
Because Brizart hasn't just provided theories. He has mapped the computational architecture of human subjective experience. He has provided a roadmap for understanding how perception is framed, how time is looped, how identity is synchronized, and how action is arbitrated. It is breathtaking.
It truly is a paradigm shift.
We started this deep dive looking at a highly restrictive legal document guarding a secret archive, talking about colloidal catastrophes and formatting faux pas. And we discovered that the theories inside that fortress fundamentally rewrite how we view our own minds.
It's a journey.
If you take nothing else away from this, remember this. Think about your own life right now. Listening to my voice is a PFT frame. That frame is cycling through your TFL temporal loop, stitching seconds together. You are syncing with your environment through SST feedback, maintaining your identity. And your brain is silently calculating IRE vectors against your current fatigue threshold, deciding what you are going to do the moment this deep dive ends. You are the loop.
And as a final thought to ponder, consider the profound irony of the Brizart Research Archive. Jason Brizart has created cognitive frameworks built entirely around the ideas of fluidity, continuous updating, and dynamic resonant integration with the environment. He has proven mathematically that the human mind must be flexible, open to disruption, and adaptable to survive.
That's the core message of his work.
Yet to protect these living, breathing ideas in the real world, he had to build the most rigid, legally inflexible, and punishingly static licensing agreement imaginable. He built a cage of absolute control to house a theory of total fluidity.
It really makes you wonder, in a modern world of infinite information, AI scraping, and constant frictionless sharing, is locking an idea behind a strict legal boundary the only way to ensure it retains its structural coherence? Are open source ideas doomed to degrade? Think about that next time you blindly click accept on the terms and conditions.